Just before 9 o'clock, I took everything down to the car. Tom was on parade, showered and dressed. Liv didn't follow us down. She would be emptying the house tonight and was probably already busy getting it sterile. She'd take our bags with her, handing them back with the money in them. Tom and I faced each other as I checked him out. First his pockets, to make sure the only stuff in them was the equipment he needed. Daps, spare hook, nylon loop, and money. He didn't need 100 marks in change rattling around in his pockets, just the paper money in a plastic bag tucked into his boot to get food and transport if he was in the shit. Most important was the ThinkPad and leads, jammed into the nylon carry bag hanging over his shoulder but under his coat. I didn't want the battery getting too cold and slow on target. I then had to make sure that none of it fell out, especially his spare hook. I got him to jump up and down. There were no noises, and everything stayed in place in his large, padded blue check coat. Finally, I made sure he had his gloves and hat. "All right, mate?" "No trauma." He sounded convincing. I put the day sack on over my coat. We looked like Tweedledum and Tweedledee. "Okay, you check me now."
"Why?"
"Because I might have fucked up."
"Go on."
He checked me over from the front first. Then I turned so he could check the day sack was securely fastened. Everything was fine until I jumped up and down. There was a noise coming from the pocket my spare hook was in. Tom looked almost embarrassed as he reached in and brought out the 2 nails that had been rattling around. "These things happen," I said. "That's why everyone needs to be checked." "Thanks, mate." He was very pleased with himself. It's amazing what a couple of well-placed nails can do to boost someone's confidence and make them feel they're contributing to things. Tom and I got into the car and wheels turned just after 9 o'clock. Liv still hadn't made an appearance to say goodbye. He was pretty quiet for the first 20 minutes or so. As I drove, I talked him through each phase again. From stopping the car when we got there, to entering the house and finding what we were looking for, to me turning the ignition back on once I had the ThinkPad securely in my possession. I concentrated on being relentlessly positive, not even beginning to suggest that things could go wrong. We got to the drop-off point after 3.5 hours, with me flapping every time I'd had to turn the wipers on to clear the windscreen of shit thrown up by cars in front, thinking that the snowfall had started. Once, in the firebreak near the targets, I killed the lights, but I left the engine running as I looked over at my passenger. "You all right, Tom?" When we'd done the drive past a couple of minutes earlier, I'd pointed out the track we were going to go down. He took a deep breath.
"Ready to roll, mate?"
"Ready to rock and roll."
I could sense his apprehension.
"Right then, let's do it."
I got out of the car, closing the door gently onto the first click, just enough for the interior light to go out. Then I unzipped my flies. Tom was on the other side of the car doing the same, exactly as I'd told him. I could only manage a little dribble as I checked the skies for even the slightest sign of snow. I couldn't see a thing in the darkness, of course, but somehow it made me feel better. I got the day sack and my coat out of the car and rested them against one of the wheels. It was bitterly cold, and the wind was getting up, each gust biting at the flesh of my face. At least we should be out of it as we moved down the track, protected by the forest, and the noise of the swaying treetops would help cover any sound we made. The bad news was that the same wind would be bringing the snow. I put my coat on and watched Tom do the same as the day sack went on my back. So far, so good. He even remembered to close his door slowly to keep the noise down. After fully closing mine, I pressed the key fob. The lights flashed as I walked round to Tom and made sure he watched me as I placed the key behind the front wheel, covering it with snow. Getting back up, I went to his exposed ear and whispered, "Remember, no flaps." I wanted him to keep his ears exposed. 2 sets were better than 1, and I still wanted him to think I needed his help, though I wasn't holding my breath on that one. He nodded as our vapor clouds billowed together in front of us. We're going to have to keep quiet now. I had to force myself to keep my mouth against his ear. This boy needed to do something about his earwax. Remember, if you want me, don't call, just touch me. Then whisper right in my ear, okay on that?
Got it.
Do you remember what to do if a vehicle comes?
Yeah. Make like Superman.
His shoulders heaved up and down as he tried to suppress a nervous laugh.
Okay, mate. Ready?
He nodded, and I clapped him on the shoulder.
Right. Let's go, then.
I felt like an old sweat in the First World War trying to coax a young bayonet over the top. I set off slowly, my ears exposed to the night, with Tom 2 or 3 paces behind. When we were about 5 meters down the track, I had a check of Baby G. It was just before 1:45. Hopefully Friends was crap tonight and they'd gone to bed. We were going down a gentle incline, coming towards the bend that would take us into line of sight of the house, when I stopped, and so did Tom, just as he'd been told to. If I stopped, he stopped. If I then laid down, so must he. Moving back to him, I put my mouth to his ear.
Can you hear that?
I backed my head away so he could listen.
He nodded. Generator. We're nearly there, mate. Need another piss?
He shook his head, and I slapped him on the head in my best, what good fun this is, sort of way, and started to walk on. Keeping in the left-hand tire rut, the compacted snow solid beneath our feet, we slowly rounded the bend. All I could hear was the wind high above us, whipping the tops of the pines, the sound of Tom moving behind. And the generator, its throbbing getting louder as we closed in. I looked up at the sky. Fuck it. It didn't matter if it snowed now or not. I was totally focused on doing the job. Even my nose and ears didn't feel as cold as they had last night. There was nothing I could do about the weather, and nothing I could do about the conditions of the contract. It was tonight or nothing, and I was desperate for the money. Once we were virtually in direct line of sight of the house, I stopped again, listened, had a good look around, then moved on another 8 or 9 steps. My night vision had fully kicked in. I'd explained to Tom how to look at things in the dark, just above or below an object to ensure a good focus, and how to protect his night vision. It was a waste of time explaining why he had to do these things. All he needed to know was how. From what I could see at this distance, there didn't appear to be any lights on in the house, nor anything else to indicate that anybody was up and about. That didn't mean, however, that I was just going to bowl up to the gate. Every few steps, I stopped, turned, and checked on Tom, giving him a thumbs up and getting a nod back. It was more for his benefit than mine. I just wanted to make him feel a bit better, knowing that somebody was thinking about him. We were a few meters short of the gap between the tree line and fence when I stopped again and listened. Tom did the same, one pace after mine. If they had NVG, night viewing goggles, and were keeping watch, we would find out very soon. There was nothing I could do about it. This was our only approach. Tilting my head so my ear pointed towards the house, I tried to listen just that little bit harder, my hearing trying to overcome the noise of the wind, while at the same time edging my eyes round in their sockets towards the house to check for movement. I must have looked like a mime artist to Tom. There was a faint glimmer of light coming from the left-hand shutter on the ground floor. It was far weaker than last night. I could only just see it. Did that mean everyone was in bed or crowded round the TV? I put my hand up in front of his face and signalled Tom to wait where he was. Then my fingers did a little walking sign motion. He nodded as I moved off into the darkness, following the wheel rut towards the gate. I was exposed to the wind once I'd passed the tree line. It was now strong enough to push against my coat, but not enough to affect my walking. Nothing much had changed on the other side of the fence. Even the 4x4 was parked in the same position. On the recce, there hadn't been any electrical current running through the fence. I would have known when I'd touched it. If there was some tonight, I was just about to find out. Biting off my right outer glove, I pulled the touch glove down and quickly felt the gate, not even taking a breath in anticipation. Fuck it. Just get on with it. If it was wired up, the shock wouldn't be any different because I'd hesitated. As I put the gloves back on, I checked the padlocks. They hadn't been left undone, not that I'd expected them to be. That would be too much like good luck. There was no way I could cut the gate chains or fence, because that would compromise the job. The bolt cutters, weighing a ton in my day sack, were only to get us out of the compound if we were compromised on target. Without them, we'd be running around in there like rats in a barrel. Getting out of a place had always been more important to me than getting in. Chapter 21. I headed back to Tom, and out of the wind. He hadn't moved an inch since I'd left him. Head down, arms by his side, a vapor cloud rising above him. Slowly easing the day sack off my shoulders, I knelt down in the wheel rut and tugged on his sleeve. Tom lowered himself to join me. You only take out one bit of kit at a time from a day sack, then deal with it, which means packing so the first item you want is the last bit you put in. Getting him to keep the day sack upright by holding the bolt cutter handles sticking out on either side of the top, I undid the clips and lifted the flap. Then, moving some of the toweling that stopped everything from rattling around, I took out one webbing loop and a hook. Twisting two turns of the strapping around the nail hook, where it emerged from the wood, I handed the device, now with a 3-foot loop hanging from it, to Tom. He gripped the wood in his right hand, exactly as he'd been shown, with the hook angled down and protruding between his index and middle fingers. Attaching another webbing loop in exactly the same way to another hook, I handed it over, and he took that in his left hand. I then assembled the other two devices in the same way and reclipped and replaced the day sack on my back, then took one in each hand. Looking around at both the target and the sky, I noticed no discernible change in either. I just hoped it would stay that way. Taking a step closer to Tom, I whispered into his ear. Ready? I got a slow nod and a couple of short, sharp breaths in return. I started to move the last few meters towards the gate. My eyes were fixed on the house, but my brain was already crossing the fence. It was going to be our most vulnerable time. If things went wrong in the house, fine, I could react. Up there on the fence, we'd be fatally exposed, just like my friend hanging from his jacket cord, watching helplessly as they walked up and shot him. I stopped, my nose 6 inches from the gate, and turned. Tom was 2 paces behind, head bent to the left, trying to keep the wind out of his face. Turning back to the gate, I raised my right hand to just above shoulder height, the hook facing the diamond-shaped lattice, and gently eased the bent nail into a gap. The elastic bands around the nail were to eliminate noise, but I deliberately left the bend itself exposed. When I heard and felt metal on metal, I'd know it was correctly in position. Otherwise, if weight was applied with a hook badly positioned, there was a possibility of the nail straightening under the strain. That was why we both had a spare device. If there was a drama, and one of these things started straightening while we climbed, the other loop and hook would have to hold our weight while the knackered one was replaced. The bend in the nail engaged the fencing with the gentlest of scrapes, the bottom of the strapping loop hanging about 1 foot above the wheel rut. I inserted the left hook about 6 inches higher and a shoulder width apart. It was pointless at this stage worrying about being so exposed to view from the house. All we could do was just get on with it, hoping they didn't see us. There was no other way. If I'd tried the previous night to find somewhere to cross on the side or rear of the building, I would have left tracks everywhere for someone to spot this morning. And my boot prints sure didn't look like reindeer hooves. Even if I'd been able to recce all the way around, I would still face the problem of sighing inside the compound. At least the front of the house was crisscrossed by footprints and tire tracks. Gripping both chunks of wood so the hooks took my body weight, I placed my right foot in the right loop and, using my right leg muscles to push my body upwards and pulling up with my hands and arms, I slowly rose above the ground. As the loop began to take the strain, I could hear the nylon creaking, stretching just a few millimeters as the fibers sorted themselves out. The gates and chains rattled as the structure moved under my weight. I'd expected this to happen, but not so loudly. I froze for a few seconds and watched the house. Satisfied that the right loop was supporting me, I lifted my left into the bottom of the one about 6 inches higher. I was now a foot off the ground, only about another 44 to go. I didn't bother looking at Tom again. From now on, I was going to concentrate on what I was doing, knowing that he would be watching me closely and that he knew what was required of him. I shifted my body weight again until all the pressure was on my left foot and hand. Now it was this loop's turn to protest as it stretched that few millimeters for the first time. Lifting out the right hook but keeping my foot in the loop, I reached up and put it back into the fence 6 inches above the level of the left one, again a shoulder width apart. Tom was right. It was like Spider-Man climbing a wall, only instead of suction pads, my hands had hooks, and my feet had loops of nylon strapping. I repeated the process twice more, trying to control my breathing through my nose as my body demanded more oxygen to feed the muscles. I checked below me. Tom was looking up, his head angled against the wind. I wanted first to gain height and clear the snowdrifts in the gap, then traverse left over them and continue climbing near a support post. I didn't want us to climb directly above the wheel rut, not only because a vehicle or people might appear at the gates, but also because the higher we climbed, the more noise the fence would make as our weight moved it about. I was aiming for the first of the steel poles that the lattice sections were fixed to. If we climbed with our hooks each side of it, it would stop the fence from buckling and lessen the noise. I now moved vertically to the left 6 inches at a time. After three more moves, I was off the gates and onto the fence proper, and halfway up the first of the three sections that gave the fence its height. The smooth, unmarked snow was a couple of meters below me. There were still a few feet to go before I reached the support, but I didn't want to get too far away from Tom. Stopping, I looked down at him and nodded. It was his turn to play now and follow my route. He took his time. There was a slight grunt as he took the weights on his right leg, and I hoped he remembered what I'd said, that it was all in the leg muscles, even though that was a lie. He'd need quite a bit of upper body strength as well, but I wasn't going to tell him that. I didn't want to put him off before he'd even started. The gate moved and the chains rattled far too loudly for comfort. Thankfully, the wind was blowing from left to right, carrying some of our noise away from the building. Tom hadn't quite got the hang of how to balance himself. As he went to insert his left foot in the loop, he started to swivel to the right, forcing himself round to the left so he was flat against the fence once again. I could hear clown music playing in my head already. As I looked down at him under my right armpit, I thought of all the other times I'd had to climb over obstacles or move along roofs with people like Tom, experts in their field, but simply unused to anything that demanded more physical coordination than boarding a bus or getting up from a chair. It nearly always ended up in a gangfuck. He looked so ridiculous that I couldn't help smiling, even though his incompetence was the last thing I needed right now. For a moment, I thought I'd have to go back down to him, but he eventually got his left foot into the loop and made his first ascent. Unfortunately, he was so jittery that he started to swing over to the left as he released the right hook from the fence. Tom worked hard at it, huffing and grunting as he struggled to sort himself out. Then, strangely, he found the traverse a bit easier. He still looked a bag of shit, but he was making progress. I kept my eyes on target while he made his way towards me. Moving up and across a few more times, my hooks were soon each side of the first support. The massive steel pole was maybe a foot in diameter. I waited again for Tom, who was generating less noise now that he traversed onto the more rigid fence. The wind burned my exposed flesh as I forced myself to look around and check. The snot from my runny nose felt as if it was freezing on my top lip. Ages later, Tom's head was less than a meter below my boots. Beneath us lay a deep drift of snow which extended back 5 meters to the tree line. Now that we both had a hook on each side of the support, the going was good and firm. All we had to do from here was climb vertically and get over the top. Pulling one hook away at a time, I checked the nails. They were standing up to the strain. Tom was going at it like this was Everest, great clouds of vapour billowing round him as he panted for breath, his head moving up and down with the effort of sucking in more oxygen. He'd be sweating big time under his clothes, as much from the pressure he was under as from the huge amount of physical energy he was needlessly exerting. I moved another 6 inches, then another, edging my way upwards, wishing we were going a bit quicker. About 2/3 of the way up, I looked down again to check on Tom. He hadn't moved an inch since I'd last done so, his body shape flat against the fence, holding on for dear life. I couldn't tell what had happened, and there was no silent way of attracting his attention. I willed him to look up at me. He'd completely frozen, a common occurrence when people climb or abseil for the first time. It certainly has nothing to do with lack of strength. Even a child has enough muscle to climb. But some people's legs just give out on them. It's a mental thing. They have the strength and know the technique, but they lack the confidence. At last, he looked up. I couldn't make out his expression, but his head was shaking from side to side. From this distance, there was no way I could reason with him or offer assurance. Fuck it. I'd have to go down to him. Extracting the right hook, I began descending and traversing to the left. This was turning into a Billy Smart circus act. Getting level with him, I leaned across until my mouth was against his left ear. The wind picked up more and I had to whisper louder than I wanted. "What's the matter, mate?" I moved my head round to present an ear for his reply, watching the house as I waited.
"I can't do it, Nick. I'm fucked."
It came out somewhere between a sob and a whimper.
"I hate heights. I should have told you. I was going to say, but, you know..."
It was pointless showing him how pissed off I was. It's just the way some people are. It's no good shaking them or telling them to get a grip. If he could, he would. I knew he wanted to get over the fence just as much as I did.
"Not a problem."
Moving his head away from mine, he looked at me, half nodding, half hoping I was going to call it a day. I got my mouth into his ear again.
"I'll stay alongside you all the time, just like I am now. Just watch what I do and follow, okay?"
As I checked the house, I heard him sniffing. I looked back. It wasn't just snot. He was in tears. No point rushing him. Not only did we have to get over, but we had to do it again once we'd done the job. If it started snowing now, this really would turn into Billy Smart's evening performance. My feet were in the wrong position. His right foot was down, but mine was up. Moving to alter that, I put on my best bedside manner.
"We'll just take it nice and easy. Lots of people are scared of heights. Me, I don't like spiders. That's why I like coming this far north. There's none of the fuckers here. Too cold, know what I mean?"
He gave a little nervous laugh.
"Just keep looking at the top of the fence, Tom, and you'll be okay."
He nodded and took a deep breath.
"All right? I'll go first. One step, then you follow, all right?"
I slowly put my weight on the left strap, moved up one and waited for him. He shakily raised himself up level with me. We did the same again. I leaned towards his ear.
"What did I tell you? Piece of piss?"
While I was close to him, I quickly checked his hooks. They were fine. I decided to let him have a rest, let him bask in his glory and gain some confidence.
"We'll rest here a minute, all right?"
The wind gusted around us, picking up ground snow in flurries. Tom was staring straight ahead at the fence, just inches from his face. I was watching the house, both of us sniffing snot. When his breathing had calmed down, I gave him a nod. He nodded back, and I started climbing again, and he kept pace, stride for stride. We reached the top of the second of the three sections. Tom was getting the hang of it. A dozen or so more pulls on each side would take us to the top. I leaned across. I'll go up there first and help you over the top, okay? I needed to traverse again. I wanted to cross away from the top of the pole so we didn't kick off any of the snow that had collected on its top. Something like that would be too easy to notice in daylight. Tom was getting worried again and started to slap my leg. I ignored it at first. Then he grasped my trousers. I looked down. He was in a frenzy, his free hand waving towards the track as his body swung from side to side. I looked down. A white-clad body was fighting its way through snow that was nearly waist-deep in a gap on the other side of the track. Behind him were others, and yet more were emerging from the tree line and moving directly onto the track. There must have been at least a dozen. I could tell by the position and swing of their arms that they were carrying weapons. Shit. Maliskaya.
Nick! What do we do?
I'd already told him a few hours ago what to do if we had a drama on the fence. Do what I did.
Jump! Fuck it! Jump!
Chapter 22. Gripping the wood hard and lifting with my arms so the hooks took my body weight, I kicked my feet from the loops and let go with my hands. I just hoped the snow was deep enough to cushion my 10-meter fall. I plummeted past Tom, who was still stuck to the fence, and prepared myself for the jump instructor's command when the wind is too strong and the drop zone, which should have been a nice empty field, has suddenly become the M1. Accept the landing. I plunged into the snow feet first and immediately started a parachute roll to my right, but crumpled as my ribs banged hard against the tree stump, immediately followed by one of the handles of the bolt cutters giving me the good news on the back of my head. It was starburst time in my eyes and brain. Pain spread outwards from my chest, the snow that enveloped me muffling my involuntary cry. I knew I had to get up and run, but I couldn't do a thing about it. My legs wouldn't play. Eyes stinging with snow, I moaned to myself as I fought the pain and tried to work out how deep I was buried. Tom had found the courage to jump. I heard the wind being knocked out of him as he landed to my left, on his back. I still couldn't see anything from under the snow. He recovered, panting hard.
Nick! Nick!
The next thing I knew, he was towering over me, brushing the snow from my face.
Nick! Come on, mate! Come on!
My head was still spinning, my coordination screwed. I was no good to him. I knew it would be only seconds before we were caught.
Station, Tom. Go, go!
He made an attempt to pick me up by my arms and drag me, but there was no way that was going to happen. It would have been hard enough for him in normal conditions, let alone in deep snow.
Tom, the station. Go, just fuck off!
His breathing labored a second time as he tried to take me with him. The pain in my chest increased as he pulled my arms, only to be relieved as he let me drop back down. At last, he'd got the message. I opened my eyes to see him pulling the spare hook out of his coat. For a split second, I couldn't work out why, and then I heard grunting right behind me. The Maliskaya had got to us. Tom launched himself over me. There was the sound of a thud and a scream that was too low-pitched to be his. The next thing I knew, Tom fell beside me, sobbing. There wasn't any time for that shit. He had to go. I pushed him away from me with my hands. Not checking behind him, he left, stumbling over me on the way. I wanted to follow, but couldn't. Rolling over onto my stomach and pushing myself onto my hands and knees, I started to drag myself up out of the hole. As I crested the top, I saw Tom's victim, just 3 meters away and trying to get to his feet. He brought his weapon up, blood oozing from the thigh of his white, cold weather gear and all around the climbing hook that was embedded in it. Diving back down into the snow, I heard the unmistakable, low-level click-thud, click-thud, click-thud of an SD, the suppressed version of the Heckler & Koch MP5. The click was the sound of the working parts as they ejected an empty case and moved forward to pick another from the magazine. The thud was the gas escaping as the subsonic round left the barrel. I heard another click-thud, click-thud, as two more rounds were fired. I wasn't his target, but I lay there not wanting to move and risk getting hit. I wasn't even too sure if he knew I was there. The firing stopped, and I heard short, sharp breaths as the hooked body took the pain. Then more arrived, and I heard a shout.
Okay, buddy, it's okay.
My pain suddenly disappeared, to be replaced by an enormous feeling of dread. Shit. They were Americans. What the fuck was I in here? The hooked man answered haltingly between anguished gasps.
Help me to the track, man. Ah, sweet Jesus.
They were swarming all around me, and I knew it wouldn't be long before I got the good news. I turned my head, and as I opened my eyes and looked up, two white-covered figures with black balaclavas under their hoods were nearly on top of me, their breath clouds hanging in the cold night air. Hovering over me, one pointed his weapon soundlessly at my head. It's okay, mate. I'm not going anywhere. The other came forward, snow crunching beneath his boots, keeping out of his mate's line of fire. Vapor was the only thing coming from his mouth. There still wasn't any communication between them. I heard gasps and labored breathing as Tom's victim was helped back to the track. He was in a bad way, but he'd live. Other bodies passed, pushing hard through the waist-high snow, heading in the same direction as Tom. Any thought of escape or trying to give them a hard time was laughable. I curled up and waited for the inevitable subduing, closing my eyes and gritting my teeth to protect my tongue and jaw. The breathing was now directly overhead, and I could feel their boots disturbing the snow around me as I waited for the first kick to open me up for a surge. It didn't happen. Instead, a cold, snow-covered glove pulled my hands from my face, and I caught a glimpse of a canister. I didn't know if it was CS, CR liquid, or pepper, and it didn't really matter. Whichever it was, and even if I closed my eyes, it was going to fuck me over big time. The moment I felt the ice-cold liquid make contact, my eyes were on fire. My nose filled instantly with even more snot, and I felt as if I was choking. The flames spread all over my face. I was conscious of what was going on, but was totally incapacitated. There was nothing I could do but let it take its course. As I choked and retched, a hand forced my face back into the snow. There were no commands to me, or any communication between the bodies. Snorting and gasping like a suffocating pig, I struggled for oxygen, trying to move my head against the hand that was still holding it down, desperate to clear the snow pressing on my face so I could breathe, but he wasn't letting that happen. A kick aimed at the side of my stomach got between my arms, which were wrapped protectively around it, and I half-coughed, half-vomited the mucus that had built up in my mouth and nose. As I rolled with the pain, Sprayman pulled me onto my back, arched because of the day sack. My neck stretched as my head fell backwards. I was still choking and snot was running into my eyes. A gloved fist hit me across the head and my jacket was unzipped. Hands ran over my body and squeezed my coat pockets. They found the spare hook, the vegetable knife, the makeshift Yale gun. Everything was taken from me, even the Polaroid film. One of them pressed his knee into my stomach with all his weight, and vomit flew from my mouth. The taste and smell of strong tea from the journey filled the air around me as it spilt onto the snow. I tried lifting my head to cough up the last remaining bits in my throat, only to be slapped down. There was nothing I could do but try to keep breathing. The character kneeling on my stomach was joined by the weapon pointer on my right-hand side, and his freezing, fat muzzle raked against my face, pushing into the skin. The two of them just knelt there, waiting. The only sounds were their heavy breathing and me snorting like a pig. They knew I was fucked and were just maintaining me in that position. From what I could make out through watery, painful eyes, they looked far more concerned with what was going on by the gate. I knew I had to recover from the impact of the fall and the spray before doing anything about getting out of this shit. I accepted I had no control over myself physically, but I still had control of my mind. I had to watch for opportunities to escape, and the quicker I tried to do it, the better chance I would have of succeeding. There is always confusion in the heat of things. Organization only comes later. I analyzed what I had seen. They were all in winter warfare whites. They even all had the same weapons and were highly organized, and at least two of them spoke English with American accents. This wasn't the Malaskaya, and this wasn't about commercial intelligence. I started to feel even worse about my future prospects, and was pissed off big time with Liv and Val, who obviously hadn't told me everything. I just hoped I'd be able to get my own back. I thought about Tom, and hoped that if he was alive he'd make it back to the real world as quickly as he could. He had tried to save me. The bullseye with the hook was probably more to do with luck than skill, but at least he'd had the bollocks to do it. Winning a fight isn't important. It's having the bottle to get stuck in that is. I'd been wrong about him. As I lay passively facing the sky, I felt something wet and cold dissolve on my lips. The first heavy flakes of a snowfall. The few seconds of silence were broken by the crunch of snow coming from the direction of Tom's escape route. It must be the bodies returning from pursuing Tom or collecting his corpse. I tried to look, but my vision was too blurred for me to see anything. I was down in my hole, and they didn't walk near enough for me to see if they had him. If so, he must be dead. I couldn't hear him, and I assumed he'd be in pain if shot, or crying if captured, thinking about returning to jail. There was the crash of the chain as the gate was forced open, but still no sound from the two with me. Their silence made the situation feel even scarier than it was already. Tom and I were probably a sideshow they hadn't been expecting. They must have had their hands covering their mouths, trying not to scream with laughter, watching our attempt to climb the fence, just biding their time for when we were at our most vulnerable. Whatever we were trying to get hold of, so were they. That scared me very much. It seemed the race wasn't only against the Malaskaya. Things were happening at the house. The front door was being battered, then I heard screaming cutting through the wind. Men's voices that couldn't be from one of the teams. These were the voices that went with high-pitched, big-time flapping. My two new friends were still looking around, and whatever they were waiting for, they got it. Muzzleman tapped Sprayman on the shoulder, and they both stood up. It was obviously time to go. As soon as the pressure on my stomach was released, I was thrown over onto my front, face down in the snow, while the left-hand strap on my day sack was cut, accompanied by their labored breathing. My right arm was dragged behind me as it was pulled away from my body. Gritting my teeth, I took the pain it generated in my chest. Then I was kicked over onto my back again, and I brought my knees up instinctively to protect myself. I didn't want eye contact. Not that much of it could be done in this darkness, but I wouldn't want them to construe any look I might give them as defiance and get them sparked up, or as a sign that I wasn't as injured as I was trying to pretend. Through semi-closed, angled eyes, I could only see one of them, swinging his weapon on its chest sling until it was across his back. Nightmare sounds were still coming from the house as he knelt down, gripping my throat with one wet, cold, gloved hand, putting another round the back of my neck, and started to pull me to my feet. I wasn't going to resist at this stage, and jeopardize any chance of escape. As my body emerged from the snow hole, the wind started hitting the tears and mucus on my face. My snot started to feel like freezing jelly. I was frog-marched, with hands still in place around my throat, following tracks that had already been made in the snow. Not leaving sign didn't seem to be a high priority for these boys. We went through the now open gate. I could feel the wind forcing the falling snow against my face and hear the crunching footsteps of my escorts. Looking towards the house, I felt like I'd dived into a swimming pool and was moving up towards the surface, the shimmering shapes and sounds slowly becoming more distinct. I made out more white shapes through the snow falling in front of me, in the lights that were now blazing on both floors. There were ransacking noises, furniture being thrown about and glass breaking, but the screaming had stopped. Still not a murmur from the team. The only reason the injured guy and his helper had spoken was probably because they hadn't realized where I'd landed. I was dragged past the 4x4 and bounced onto the wooden veranda, my shins banging painfully against the steps, no doubt adding to the bruises I'd got last night. They carried on along the veranda with me, the sound of their footsteps echoing along the boards. A battering ram had been abandoned on the threshold, a long steel pole with two rectangular handles on either side. The top hinge of the door had been pushed in, and the bottom one was holding the door at a 45-degree angle inwards, the glass from its windows in shards on the floor. These guys hadn't bothered with electric toothbrushes. We crunched over the broken glass and entered the house. The warmth enveloped me, but there wasn't time to enjoy it. A few paces inside, I was forced face down onto the wooden floor of the hallway. To my right were three other people, tied up and faced to the floor, two of them in just boxer shorts and t-shirts. Maybe this was the reason there was no voice contact. They didn't want these three to know who they were. The three captives looked about Tom's age, with long blonde hair. One of them had his done-up in a ponytail. Another was crying, and his hair was sticking to his wet cheeks. Shit. And I'd been worrying how many bayonets would be on target. They looked at me with the same question in their eyes as I had in my head. Who the fuck are you? I looked away. They weren't important to me. Working out how to separate myself from these Americans was. As I turned my head, a boot tapped me on the side of the face and motioned for me to look down. I rested my chin on the floor and my hands were forced in front of me, where they could be seen. They'd taken prisoners before. I counted a few seconds, then lifted my eyes and tried to look around, trying to gather as much information as possible to help me escape. I saw no scenes of frenzy. Everybody seemed to know what they were doing. There was a lot of efficient movement by bodies in white, some with their hoods down, exposing their black balaclavas. There are many different reasons for wearing uniform, but mainly, in situations like this, it's for identification purposes. The atmosphere seemed to be that of an efficient open-plan office. They were all armed. Everybody had the same type of weapon, all suppressed. The pistol that each of them carried was very unusual. It had been a long time since I'd seen a P7, but, if I remembered correctly, it fired 7.62mm rounds. There were seven barrels, each about 6 inches long, and contained within a disposable, Bakelite-type plastic unit. The unit was sealed and watertight, and clipped into a pistol grip. The rounds were fired conventionally by pulling the trigger, but instead of a firing pin, an electrical current was sent to one of the barrels each time the trigger was pulled, via terminals, which married up when the barrels and grip were clipped together. The power source was a battery in the pistol grip. Once all seven rounds had been fired, you simply removed the barrel unit, threw it away, and put on another one. The P7 was originally designed to be fired at divers at close range and underwater, to penetrate their diving sets and, of course, their bodies. I didn't know if they were any good at longer range. All I knew was that they were silent and extremely powerful. Because of their size, they were being carried by these guys in shoulder holsters over their whites, along with thick, black nylon belt kit that held their HK mags. I can't remember who made P7s, or if it was the weapon's real name. Not that it really mattered to me at the moment. What did matter was that these people were uniformed and efficient, and they hadn't been sent here because the computers on site weren't Y2K compliant. They had to be from a security organization. CIA, maybe, or NSA. It didn't matter which. It was highly unusual for them to be carrying out such an operation within a friendly nation's territory. That sort of thing was normally left to dickheads like me, so that everything could be denied if it went wrong. The reason they were on the ground must be that they desperately wanted something that belonged to them. And, whatever it was, it must be so sensitive that they didn't want or trust anyone else to go and get it. Had I been trying to nick American secrets? I hope not. That was spying. And, with no help from HMG, I'd be lucky if I got out of prison in time to see Kelly's grandchildren. I realized what had been causing the dull glow from the left-hand side of the house. Through an open door, I could see it hadn't been room light escaping from the broken shutter, but the glare from banks of TV screens. I made out CNN, CNBC, Bloomberg, and some Japanese program, all with anchormen and women talking business. Running captions displayed financial information across the bottom of the screen. So it wasn't friends after all. I felt even more depressed. This was just like the weather, getting worse every minute. In amongst the TVs were banks of computer monitors, most of them turned off, but some with streams of numbers running vertically down the screen, just like I'd seen Tom messing about with. The computers and BDUs were being unplugged, while more white-clad figures fiddled with other machines and keyboards in the room. I saw one hand sticking out from its whites and working some keys. It was immaculately manicured, feminine, and wore a wedding ring. The rest of the horizontal surfaces were in shit state, covered with sweet wrappings, pizza boxes, cans, and large, half-empty plastic bottles of Coke. It looked like a student's flat, but with a couple of truckloads of cutting-edge technology thrown in. I realized what they'd been carrying in last night from the 4x4. It must have been pizza time. My little recce was cut short when I saw pairs of black boots coming towards me, snow still in the stitching and laces. They were Danner boots, an American brand. I knew the make well, as I had a pair, high leg with leather outer and Gore-Tex inner. The US military wore them too. The Tom lookalikes on the floor behind me were moving about or being moved. The one who'd been crying suddenly sounded muffled, as if he was resisting something. I risked turning my head to see what was happening, but I was too late. A hood got pulled over my head, smearing the snot even more over my top lip, mouth and chin. It was pointless resisting. I just let him do it as quickly as possible. I'd learned that the best thing to do was concentrate on breathing through these things and let your ears do the work. The drawstrings were pulled at the bottom, and I was in a world of total darkness. Not even the faintest glimmer of light could penetrate. My face started to sweat up rapidly as the hood moved against my mouth, and then out again as I breathed and tried to recover completely from the spray. I heard boots on both sides of my head, followed by heavy breathing as my hands were forced together in front of me, and a plastic cuff was applied. The short, sharp sound of ratcheting was accompanied by the pain of the plastic tightening around my wrists. There was more movement next to me, and the rustling of clothes. The pizza boys were getting dressed. That was a good sign. They wanted them alive, and I hoped me too. Between the sounds of muffled sobs and zips being done up, I could hear,
"Danke, kitos, spasiba, thank you."
Obviously these boys didn't know the nationality of the men in white and were hedging their bets wildly, sounding off like Brussels translators. The floorboards flexed under the pressure of bodies walking past, heading towards the door. Trailing wires and plugs dragged and clattered across the floor just past my head. Some plugs hit the steel ram in the doorway and sent out a dull ring. I presume the computers were being lugged out. By the sounds of it, everything was being piled up outside on the veranda. The roar of engines filled my hood as vehicles drove into the compound. The temperature inside the house had started to drop as the wind whistled through the main door. To my left, I could just make out the low mumble of voices, exchanging short sentences on the veranda as the vehicles approached. They stopped, and handbrakes were pulled up on lock. Engines were left running, just like a heli on an operational sortie. It never shuts down in case it doesn't start up again. Doors opened and closed, and there was a flurry of boot steps around the veranda. I could hear the creak and echo of what sounded like the door of an empty van. It was confirmed when I heard a sliding door lock into the open position. This area was beginning to sound like a superstore's loading bay. I tried moving my arms, as if to get comfortable, but in fact to see if we were being guarded. My answer came very quickly when a boot made contact with my ribs, the same side as my fall. I stopped moving and concentrated on the inside of my snot-lined hood as I took the pain. I lay there, waiting for the agony to subside. The sobbing and snuffling next to me got louder. The culprit was given the same sort of booted persuader to shut him up, but it just made him worse. The boy was flapping big time, and he made me think of Tom. I was still hoping that he wasn't dead and had got away. Or was he, like this boy, hyperventilating in a hood, stuck in one of those vehicles? The floorboards still gave, and plugs clattered and rattled out towards the veranda. Others loaded the stuff into the wagons. I could hear their boots on the van's metal floors. The floorboards bent even more as the three lying next to me were hauled to their feet, amidst muffled groans and cries. The sobbing one was dragged past me and taken outside. The others followed. As the last of the three bodies passed, I heard a scream from the first one echo inside a van. I tried to convince myself they wouldn't go to all this trouble if they didn't want us alive. As I listened to the second being manhandled after his mate, boots came for me, the creaking leather stopping just millimeters from my ear. Two pairs of large, aggressive hands grabbed each side of me, under my armpits and on the arms, dragging me upright. I let my boots trail on the floor. I wanted to appear weak and slow. I wanted them to think I wasn't any sort of threat, somebody not worth worrying about. Just a grey man in a bad way. The two guys were grunting under the strain as we crossed the threshold onto the veranda. My toe caps banged over the door ram and back down onto the wooden floor. At the same time, my hands and neck were blitzed by their freezing cold. Then it moved onto my face as the hood, made wet with my condensed breath, started to get cold inside. Stumbling between my escorts down the steps from the veranda, I was dragged straight ahead. Then all of a sudden, they stopped at the command of a gloved clap and turned right, jerking me round with them. Perhaps they were going to separate me from the others. Would that be good or bad? Within 5 seconds of being dragged in a new direction, I knew I was indeed going into a different wagon. It wasn't a cold metal box. It felt like the back seat area of a 4x4. There was a climb up to get into it, and it was carpeted and very warm. I was short-term pleased. The door opposite was opened, and hands reached over, gripping my coat and pulling me in with grunts to match the effort. My shins scraped painfully over the door sill, and I was finally pushed down into the footwell. I could feel one of the rear heating vents against my neck, blowing out hot air from under the seat. It was wonderful. Even through the hood, I could smell the newness of the interior. And for some reason, it made me feel a bit happier about my predicament. The vehicle rocked as somebody jumped into the rear seat above me, their heels digging into me one by one, followed by a muzzle jabbed into the side of my face, smearing mucus back towards my ear. Nothing was said, but I got the idea. Keep still. I was powerless to act anyway, so the best thing to do was just lie there and take advantage of the heat. Our rear doors were kept open, and the loading bay activity was still audible. A few feet away, I heard the telltale creak of a van door's retaining arm pushed back under pressure, and then slammed shut. There was a double tap on the side of the vehicle to let the driver know it was secure, but no one moved yet. We must be waiting to go in convoy. A few seconds later, another sliding door was shut, and there was silence. There was still no talking from these people, Either they were working by hand signals, or they knew exactly what to do. The vehicle's suspension went into overtime as more bodies piled in. All the doors closed, and it felt as if there were at least three people on the back seat. Boots were all over the place, a couple of pairs digging in their heels to keep me down. Another kicked my legs out of the way so he could rest his feet properly on the floor. I wasn't going to argue. We seemed to be the first vehicle to move out of the compound, in low ratio to handle the wheel ruts and ice, with the windscreen wipers slapping side to side to counter the snow. One of the people in the front was pressing switches on the dashboard. There was a burst of music, some terrible Euro pop. It was turned off, and I heard them laugh quietly. No matter who they were and what side they were working for, at the end of the day they'd just done a job, and so far it had been successful. They were releasing a little bit of tension. I couldn't tell whether we'd reached the bend, because it was a long, sweeping curve, and I wouldn't feel it at this slow speed. But I soon sensed we were driving uphill. It wouldn't be far to go now before we hit the road. I was in deep, frozen shit, and there wasn't a thing I could do about it. Chapter 23. We moved on for a few more minutes and stopped. There was a clunk as the driver disengaged low ratio and shifted into high, then set off again with a sharp left turn. We had to be on the gravel road, and the left turn meant that at least we wouldn't be driving past the Saab. That was further up on the right, towards the dead end. Did they already know where it was? Had they been here the night before, watching me carry out the recce, then followed me back to it? It made me worry about Tom again. Maybe they hadn't bothered to chase him too hard because they knew where he was heading. It wasn't whether he was dead or alive that worried me. It was just not knowing. We began to accelerate, gently. The front passenger seat back moved and creaked under what must have been a very large body pushing against my face. He was probably trying to get into a comfortable position with belt kit on. The snow was now melting off the clothing of the three in the back and dripping down my neck. It wasn't the worst thing.